opportunity to meet our speaker. And one of the things I had to share with him, this is an honest program, and I told him, I'm nervous. This is the first time I've ever done this. And he said, not to worry. He had to introduce someone to 1,000 people. And I knew I'm not alone. And that's one of the rewards of Al-Anon. I didn't tell you. My name is Sherry Marshall, and I am your chairman tonight, and I am a grateful Al-Anoner. And I'm recovering in this program one day at a time. I found talking to our speaker that and from hearing his family share that he has a lot to give, and it's obvious. And I give you Richard G. from Lawrenceville, Georgia.
Hi, I'm Richard Gabe from Lawrenceville, Georgia. Y'all are nervous, so could we do that again? I'm Richard, I'm Al-Anon. Thank you, I appreciate that. I'm going to give you all a chance to settle down. Hi, you're doing it already. I want to thank the committee for inviting our family. I know tomorrow we're going to take home much more than we brought to West Virginia. And so far, up until now, we've thoroughly enjoyed it. Pete and Jackie also appreciate it. Thank you. Talking about being nervous, I tell this story on myself time to time, and when I went up at a podium, I remember it. The first time I had the opportunity to tell my story was in front of some close people. Dwight, that Lindsay mentioned, was in the group. I guess there was about maybe a dozen people there. And it was a little country church. And if you've been in little country Baptist church, the podiums they have are normally just 4x4 timbers, and they have just a board on top of them. And they're not made to lean on and prop. They're made to hold books and things like that. Well, about halfway through that talk, I was getting engrossed in it. I thought I was doing all right. But I felt myself moving around. Didn't need a microphone. There weren't that many people. It was real close. And I was looked like the fellow on the lamppost, just weaving. And I looked down, and I had wrapped my right leg around that podium. Looked kind of like a flamingo, I guess you're seeing those. And to show you where I was in my program, I didn't think anybody noticed. I was trying to figure out how to get my foot down so nobody'd see it. If you see my foot wiggle around the outside of this thing, will you just wave or something? Let me know it. After the speakers we've had so far, Helen, I thoroughly enjoyed you last night. And David and Lindsay, I want to tell you, Anna, I've had a very rough afternoon. I have been totally empty. I haven't felt this way before. I've talked before. And it's a strange feeling. I got so much into Lindsay and David talking earlier that it's really draining for our family to do something like this. I'm not saying it from a bad standpoint, but emotionally it really, really drains you. And I was so much into their talk that I'll be honest with you, I don't know what's going to come out tonight. So if you would please, if you enjoy anything that I have to say, if you'll thank my higher power, because that's where it's coming from. If I get controversial, and I tend to do that sometime, and you'd like to say some nasty things to me later, don't worry about it. I appreciate that too. That doesn't bother me. The big book tells us to tell a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. Lindsay's and I's stories go really parallel. I came from Irish Catholic background. I was an only child, but my parents separated actually before I was born. So I was raised by my mother and grandmother. And I remember family get-togethers, and everybody used to get together. The only time we got together, though, was funerals and weddings. That's the only time the group got together. And any time it got together, everybody got drunk. And they laughed, and they partied, and they ate. And it was just a good time for all. And it didn't matter that, you know, half the people that could carried the people that couldn't out the door. That was just, that's the way it was. What I'm getting at is the drinking of alcohol and the drinking too much and getting drunk was totally acceptable as far as I was concerned growing up. It was okay behavior. In fact, it was almost something that you looked forward to. At least I did. And I want to tell you this as I go through this thing, and I don't want to forget. Please don't you forget. I'm an Al-Anon. I don't think I've had a drinking problem, but boy, I sure did consume a lot of booze in my adolescent and even early adult age. But it wasn't a problem with me, and I'll get into that a little bit later. My mother died when I was 12 of cancer, and I moved in at that time with aunt and uncle, who had two children older than me and two younger than me. At that point, I had a grandmother who was, we've got a picture of her somewhere in our files of my grandmother on Daytona Beach reading her prayer book, and I don't think that happened before or since. My son just went to Daytona after he graduated, David, when he graduated from high school. I don't think he saw anybody on the beach reading their prayer book, but that was where my grandmother was. She took me to church almost every day that I remember. But when my mother died, I got very upset with God and anything to do with Him. I felt alone. I felt like an orphan. Even though the people around me, and it was a large family, my grandmother had 10 children, typical Irish Catholic. They gave a lot of love, but I just couldn't accept it at that point. And I know today that they were doing the best they could to raise me, but I was no prince. I was extremely angry and frustrated. I kept this rebellious nature, I guess, until after I came into Al-Anon. All I did was get worse, and I call it rebellious, but it turned out that, as you and I both know, all it was resentment, piled on top of resentment, on top of resentment, on and on and on and on. I felt like I'd gotten a raw deal. I felt like I was owed something. Of course, I milked it too. I'd let the word out real quick that my mother died when I was 12, and I'd catch an old poor you, and, you know, it felt good. So the more people would say poor you, the more I'd say the story. So I used that an awful lot to get people to treat me different. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I did feel different. I always felt apart from almost any group I was ever with. I felt apart from. Even when I first came into here, being a male in Al-Anon's a little bit strange, as you can tell. There are some benefits at conferences like this. I don't have to wait in line for a restroom, which it works real well. So there's some good and bad points to this. I finally got out of high school. It took me 5 years. I just repeated a year. I didn't like what I had done the year before, and it seemed like a good idea to repeat it. I was real smart the year I repeated, too, and that felt good. And I felt like somebody. My grades the second year I repeated, my junior year, were real good. Evidently, I learned more in the junior year before than I thought I did. But I learned, and people, you know, my grades were up, so senior year got real bad. Luckily, I got into college. I don't know how that happened. I spent 2 years in college, and that wasn't working. Now, this was the time of Vietnam. And I went to school when Vietnam was just starting. Met Lindsay and got married about the... Well, when you quit school back then, you had a 2S, which deferred you from the service. When I went 1A, I got married pretty quick, and under Kennedy at that time, you were deferred from the draft if you were married, and then they changed that to having to have children, and as you know, we had children real fast, so I didn't have to serve. And I guess that was a long way around to saying I didn't want to go and I didn't have to, which I felt guilty about for a while. I don't know. My life... Looking back, there was not much plan, not much at all. I remember working in a gas station when I was a kid in high school. We used to work at the local gas station, and in turn, we could work on our cars if we helped him out pumping gas. And I remember this guy coming in, and I don't know why this guy stuck out in my mind, but he had a station wagon. It was full of kids, and I looked at that, and I said, that won't ever be me. And just a few short years later, I had an old broken-down Falcon. And it was a station wagon, but it wasn't much of a station wagon, and it was full of kids. And I didn't even know how I got there, and I didn't want to be there. I guess it's one of those things you hear now, it seemed like a good idea at the time, but all of a sudden you look back and you say, what am I doing here? I don't know anything about being a parent. But here you are, and you better do the best with what you got. I broke off with the family. I have very little family ties with my family. I've made amends, and I've done the patching up that I think is necessary and is necessary for my program, but I don't communicate with them today. No offense, but I just don't enjoy being around them. And today I'm comfortable with that. But back then it was that rebellious part of me that wanted to do everything on my own. And we did things on our own. Belligerent. The crowd I used to run around with drank a lot. We always drank. And when I met Lindsay, our typical behavior on the weekend was we'd Friday night. If you've ever been in and around Atlanta, there's a place called the Varsity, and it's a pretty big drive-in restaurant next to University of Georgia Tech. And we'd show up at the Varsity on Friday night and drink beer all night long, get drunk, work on cars all day Saturday, clean up a little bit, pick up our dates in the cars and take them to the drive-in with a case of beer in the back seat, and drink beer all night Saturday. And that's the way every weekend went. After we got married, nothing changed. We just kept drinking beer and meeting, same thing on the weekends. That's the way it was. And when I met Lindsay, she could drink as much or more than anybody in the crowd, and I thought that was pretty neat. It was expensive because most of the girls would only have a couple of beers. When I got with Lindsay, it was a little bit different. And we both had to buy about a case of beer, and it got expensive, but it was okay, and I thought that was pretty neat. And she could drink half the guys under the table, and I thought, boy, that's neat. That really is. So you can see that when we got married, we started out real smart. One thing she and I forgot to tell you. She mentioned that her family was the outcast of our family. Our family was so big in and around Atlanta that I had a guy come up to me and tell me he was my cousin, and I believed him before I disbelieved him, because we had family everywhere. And come to find out, right before Lindsay and I got married, we found out we were cousins. I think it was third, or I don't know what level, you know. We quit figuring, and so did everybody else after a while. Kind of blew my grandmother away. We had to write the Pope and get a dispensation, and we had more paperwork to get married than you would believe. But anyway, we got married. We got three. Well, you met two of them already this weekend. I guess we did okay. Alcohol was a part of our lives, and it That's the way it was. During the early part of our children's childhood, it probably wasn't that much of a part that I really recall. It was more fun and games and happy, and you know, everybody gets together. The same high school crowd got together on weekends. I don't know how and when it changed. I really can't tell you when that was. I know that I was still angry and frustrated. In the jobs I was working, I finally decided after a couple of years on an assembly line that this wasn't the job. Well, it was beneath me to work on an assembly line, so I needed to do something better. And somehow I got into sales, and I was fairly good at sales, probably not as good as I thought I was. Ended up getting us into a lot of trouble and put us bankrupt about 2 years after I got into it. I got the big head and decided I was a lot better than what I was, and really put us under a big financial stress. And I don't remember during those years drinking being that much of a part of our lives. It was real hard what we went through during that period of time. Somewhere after that, when Lindsay went back to work and the children had been born and we got them out of diapers we had three in diapers at one time, and I don't know if you've ever had a couple in diapers at one time. You don't remember much else. There's a lot of work to that. There's not much time for anything else. But after we got that kind of settled down, I guess we got into back to the way things used to be, so to speak. That's when I decided really down deep that I didn't want to be there. I guess we've been married 6 years or so, and gosh, I wanted to be a swinging single down deep. I knew I had it in me, but somehow along the line, Lindsay got the idea that she wanted me to become a swinging single, so we split up. Now, to give you an idea of how I was at that time, I remember, I knew when I left and got my apartment, which incidentally was not a swinging singles pad, I had a folding card table for a dining room table and a folding chair and a bed in a two-bedroom apartment. It wasn't much furniture. A lot of echoes in that place. And I found out when I left home that something kept reoccurring, that kept happening over and over again. Wherever I went, Richard followed me. And it was hard. I always thought it was better over here, and when I got over there, the guy inside me was still there saying the same thing to me. I can't shake that voice even today when things are wrong, and I shift over to the left a little bit, I find out I still follow myself, and this is an inside job, as you and I well know. Anyway, I was so concerned, I don't know what I was concerned with back then, but I remember Lindsay used to go out and party. And I knew she partied and she was having a good time. She was having a time that I wanted to have when I left. And I used to call up, make sure that she didn't lose her job. She couldn't lose her job. She lost her job. She wouldn't have the money she was bringing in, and then she'd have to take more of my money, and I didn't have much money anyway. And I don't know whether you can follow that, but boy, it sounded sane to me. So I'd call her every morning to get her out of bed to make sure she'd make it work. Now, my apartment was about, 10 miles from where our apartment used to be, which happened to be about 2 miles from where I worked, my job. If it was 2 miles, it was. I called her one morning, nobody answered the phone, so I got in my car, drove out there, got her up. She didn't answer the phone is what it was. Got her up, got the kids ready, took them to the nursery, which is another 5 miles on the other side of that, drove back to my apartment, took a shower, and drove 2 miles to work. And I thought that was just sane, normal behavior. That's the way it worked. And I did that over and over again. It turned out she'd never set the alarm. She had somebody to come out there and do all the work for her. Never dawned on me that there was another way. We found out later, and I don't know why, we got back together after about 2 or 3 months. Lovey-dovey for a little while, things cranked up. We did it over again. We separated 3 times before we got here. One of the last times I decided to become a hippie, and I moved down in the hippie district, got me a Volkswagen van. I literally would go to work with a coat and tie on. I couldn't make decisions, and I didn't know which place I wanted to be in, so I'd get in a coat and tie and leave before everybody in the neighborhood got up, drive to work, come back, put on my blue jeans and sandals, and walk around the park with all the people. And the next morning, just do it all over again. I smoked dope. Smoked grass for over 10 years. Did my best to convince Lindsay to stop drinking and start smoking because that's where it was at and we wouldn't have to worry about the drinking anymore. That's the way it was. I did some escaping during that time too, I've got to tell you that. That was my escape. Lindsay would get drunk, I would get stoned, and I don't know, we'd wake up in the morning and say, we had a good time last night. And neither one of us knew what the heck was going on. Anyway, this crazy lifestyle just kept going. We got together again after my hippie stage, and I talked her into becoming that semi-hippie lifestyle with me. And we wouldn't walk in the park, but we'd do equally crazy things, drive around in the van and look like hippies. Had a beard, had a full beard. It was really a trip. A couple of more incidents I want to get to you, and then I want to get to the good part of this program. I didn't understand what was going on. I knew things were bad, but I couldn't explain them to anybody. And when they were over with in the morning, I'd think back to the night before and wonder what was going on. This illness of alcoholism, I personally feel, is probably one of the most horrendous illnesses there is. I mean, bar none, there is none worse than the disease of alcoholism. Because of what happens to us spiritually and emotionally and physically, I was eating myself up physically with this illness. I was watching what was going on, and in the morning, I'd be convinced that I was the totally crazy one and that what happened really wasn't that bad. It was so bad, the things that were going on. I'm not saying we didn't have fun times, but my fun times then aren't even close to my bad times today. That's the way it relates. And things were so bad that if you got a little bitty crumb of good, boy, you felt like you had a great day going. Lindsay'd call up in the evening, typical day in the Gabe household. I'd leave my office at 5:45 because it was a 15-minute ride to pick up the kids. They had to be picked up at 6 o'clock. I always picked them up at 6 o'clock on the nose. I would stay around the office for 45 minutes, even if no one was there. I'd sit there by myself until 5:45 to go pick up my children. I didn't want to be around my children, and I didn't want to be around my family, and I'd do anything to stop that. I'd go around and pick them up at 5:45. I'd pick them up at 6 o'clock, drive home, which is another 15 minutes or so, and Lindsay wouldn't be home. Phone would ring about 7 o'clock. She'd say, I'm having a couple of drinks with the fellas from the office. I'd get angry. We'd have a fight. She'd show up sometime between 11 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the morning. We'd have a big fight, go to bed, go out to breakfast in the morning after we took the kids to the nursery, and talk about how this would never, ever happen again. And it happened over and over and over and over and over. And I'd always say, this will be the last time. And I really believed that, and I believed that. We were both fighting the illness of alcoholism. It was taking our family over. Should have known something. She mentioned her mother. Her mother and I, you talk about the mother-in-law, son-in-law that you hear jokes about, that was us. I hated that woman from the top of her head to the tip of her toe. Very few people would I tell then or today that I didn't like them except her. I made an exception in her case, and every chance I got, I literally despised that woman. You see, right before we got married, when she was at the peak of her practicing, we used to have run-ins together, and she'd be totally drunk, probably in a blackout, I know today, and we'd have run-ins with each other. Now, no telling where I was, whether I was stone cold sober or whether I'd been with Lindsay and had whatever we were drinking at the time. But whenever we had a run-in, it was like two cats holding them by the tail on a clothesline. I mean, we'd just go at each other and almost kill each other. When she died, she was 13 years sober. I never saw the sober person. Whenever I saw her face, I thought about the woman I saw when she was drunk, and that's the person I saw. And she spoke, loved conventions, talked all over the country. From what we understand, people that I've met, she was probably one of the neater AAs around, and I never got to meet her that way. I never allowed myself. The resentment had eaten me up that much. I hated that woman. And I guess it's my way of making amends to her today, because I never got a chance to. Lost my train of thought, I'm sorry. The incident on Halloween, well, there was one before then. There were two things that happened, and I'll get on with some sobriety. I decided if you couldn't fight them with the drinking, you drink with them. And I was good at that, and I knew I could hold my own. So she had a bar. I loved Helen's story about burning the bar down. It's a good thing that we didn't know each other earlier. I never thought about doing that. It's closed today, but boy, I can... When you were telling that story, I could picture the flames going up at that place called Maudie's. It just looks so pretty. Anyway, she said, come on down, meet some of my friends, and come on down at lunch. So I came on down at lunch, and the bar was only a couple of miles from where I was working at the time. So I went by there at lunch, and all these guys are there, and Lindsay's sitting in the middle of them. Everybody's laughing and joking, and I walked in. They got a little quiet. I know today that, boy, I was just not the nicest person to be around. That inside that we want to hold in won't stay in long. It comes out. It comes out our pores. It came out mine anyway. I could be smiling, and I think people would say, gosh, what's wrong with this guy? I'd walk into the bar, and people got quiet. Anyway, I didn't stay there long because I had to go back to work. And I went back to work about 1 o'clock and agreed to meet her about 5:15, 5:30 back there. And met her back there, and they turned out they'd never left. So they were having fun at a party. Next thing I knew, about 5 minutes after I got there, Lindsay and I was sitting at a table by ourselves, and everybody else had left. They'd either moved to another place, and I was sitting there with Lindsay. Happy person. I was real cheery. Next thing you knew, and I don't even know why, we were in a fight. It was the same fight we would have had over the telephone, but it just so happens that I was sitting there, and we had it face to face. She jumped in our new car to leave, and I realized that she'd been drinking all day, and she was drunk. Now, this 5 o'clock traffic in Atlanta on a Friday, and she jumped in our new little Datsun, and she roars out from this place, and I decided it was time to get her. So I jumped in my van. It was a Volkswagen, too, and they aren't too fast. But I started chasing her. I used to watch a lot of television and go at the movies. It always works on television. Part of me, down deep, it felt real exciting to be, you know, I was getting some real excitement in my life chasing a drunk down the road. But to show you where my head was, she wrecked that car that night and I watched. I don't know why. Well, the hand of God stepped in because I didn't believe in God at this time and stopped going to church. Very angry person. But that car swerved across 3 lanes of traffic in 5 o'clock traffic, bounced off a light pole, and went back in the line of traffic like she just pulled out on the expressway. Tore up the side, ripped the car to shreds, and she's going right down the expressway like nothing happened. two emotions came across me at the same time, and as a joke about it, but my emotion was the same. The first one was, it's over. Finally, it's over. I don't have to worry about this happening anymore. She's going to die, when I saw the car go out across the expressway. Then when I saw it straighten up, I got angry. The emotion of killing her, though, was there, and it was real, and I wanted her to die. Down deep, I wanted her to die. And then I got so mad about her wrecking my car, I couldn't catch her. And I'll tell you anyway, but I finally caught up to her at a stoplight, and I got out of my car and ran up to her car and knocked on the window, and the light turned green. She took off, and I'm standing there in the middle of the road, people blowing their horns, honking, screaming at me. She's floating off down the road. Those people just didn't understand that she had a problem. This is a family illness. I mean, really. I got her, though. The deep down in me got her, because I never fixed the car, never filed an insurance claim. I ruined a $2,000 automobile, just left it the way it was. And she got to drive it that way the rest of the time. That was the anger down deep in me. And that's the way it was. One other time she mentioned that when she was laying in the hospital and looked up. It's funny, I don't remember the choice when she'd overdosed on those pills. I do remember we were real heavy into sports. David mentioned that, into the football league and all that. And she was active. I just hung around, you know. Lindsay has always met people. She's been vivacious. If you saw her up here. And I just kind of hung around her and met people, and it was neat because she'd meet people and I'd meet people. I didn't know anybody on my own. I was terrified of meeting. I was terrified of people, period. We were real active in this football league. But anyway, Lindsay, and we went through that thing on Halloween, and she was in a hospital, and they pumped her stomach, and she looked up, and I don't remember her making a choice, because I think I wanted her to go in the hospital, too. I didn't want to take her home. So we took her to the hospital. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. We're getting checked into the state hospital, and they got 12 forms. Hope nobody's involved with that part of it. I don't know how they are in West Virginia, but gosh, in Georgia, 12 forms, 4 o'clock in the morning. She's coming off overdose and booze, and I'm sitting there crazy. And we're filling out, and they get down to the part where it says, do you drink? And we looked at each other, smile like the cute couple we are, and said, socially. He checked it. He checked it. It was okay. Checked her in the hospital. Now I find out I got a wife in a mental institute for trying to OD on drugs. I got a football league that's rolling along expecting Lindsay to be there the next morning. Trying to figure out what to do. Well, the best thing I could come up with was that Lindsay's mother got worse in Texas, and we had to fly Lindsay out in the middle of the night. That seemed like a good idea. So I told him that. Well, you know what little leagues do when somebody's in a hospital. They took up a collection for flowers, asked me where to send them. Some hospital got some flowers. We lie to get ourselves into more lies and more lies and more covering up and more covering up. And it's just a never-ending circle. And the more I did that, the lonelier I got. I had friends tell me that I was putting pressure on Lindsay, that I needed to back off. And I thought, gee, you horrible person, why don't you back off on her and let her live, which is what the program talks about. But I didn't have any place to go. That mother-in-law of mine, at this time, she probably had 11 years of sobriety. That was my help. All I had to do was to pick up the phone and call that woman, and it was there. And I refused. Anytime I heard her name, the hair would go back on my neck, and I knew she was in AA. But see, alcohol wasn't our problem. It was something else. I didn't know exactly what it was, but boy, you can bet your bottom dollar that my wife wasn't an alcoholic because her mother was. And those two would never come together like that. Anyway, that worked out. I broke Lindsay out of the hospital. I was going to break her out, but finally after calling, I found out once you got them in, you can't get them out. And I had to get her out. And I finally called the director at home twice in the evening, got him up from his dinner table, and he got her out quick. It's funny, when I went to visit Lindsay, I remember him locking the place behind me when I go in to visit. And I didn't talk much while I was in there. I was afraid. I wanted him to give me a badge when I came in and said, he's okay. I was really, honest to God, I was so afraid when I came in the door that they were going to say, hey, this one's worse than that one. You keep him, let her go. See, I knew down deep I was crazy. I knew I was crazy. But I didn't know what to do about it. I really didn't know what to do about it. Gosh, it's a lonely, frustrating period. Lindsay went into that controlled drinking she talked about, and that was probably one of the most miserable years of my life. I spent time, I took days off from work and followed her. Remember the movies? It ain't like the movies, folks. If you ever want to follow somebody, it doesn't work that way. She did exciting things like went to Burger King and the grocery store and things, and I'm sneaking back, keeping two cars between us and doing, I knew she was either seeing another guy or getting drunk on the side before I got home. I knew one of those two things was happening. I was going to catch her at it. And I went 9 months doing this. I mean, 9 months of my life I did this. We'd go out drinking with friends, and she'd have two beers and come home, and I'd say, it's got to happen. She's got to get drunk. Today I look back, and I know that she had to get drunk. If she didn't get drunk, my life was going to go crazy. She couldn't stop drinking. Because I realized that I had some serious problems down deep. But as long as she was drinking, I could hang all of my problems on the fact that she drank. Every single one. It was like a hook on a wall that said alcohol. And I don't know that today, but it was an alcoholism hook. And I hang every problem I ever had went on that hook. Gosh, I didn't have any problems in the world. That was easy. Yeah. It was all her fault. If she quit drinking this, we'd have a better house, I'd have a better job, the kids would be better, and all these other things because she drank. Well, she made that trip out to Dallas, got off the plane, said she was going to join AA, and my heart did a flip because something in her eye told me this was for real, this was for good. And I saw the hook on the wall come off, and you know what fell on the floor. And I didn't like that. That scared me. I trembled. Also, her mother was in AA, and even though her mother was dying, I didn't want her to become like her mother. It was still there. Well, she started going to her meetings, and for the AAs here in the group, I love you to death, I do, but I hated the ground you walked on. I hadn't seen you, I didn't know you, but you were my mother-in-law, and that was it. You see, I'd been, these children that Lindsay was talking about being Donna, I was the one that cooked and did all that for those kids. I don't walk down the grocery store and see a hamburger helper that I don't get something run up my spine. I wouldn't have that in my house today. No offense for anybody that's involved, but that's what my kids ate. If it didn't come in a can or a box, we couldn't eat it. And I abused them mentally through those years terribly because I couldn't get to Lindsay, I got to the kids. And they carry some of the bruises from that period of time. I'm not proud of that, but I didn't physically. I did too. I used to hit them, not fist-wise. I'd always pull a spanking, you know. But I up until recently, I remember flinching at jumping at my kids and hollering, and I remember them flinching and drawing back and covering themselves up. And one time they did that, and I thought, my God, what are you doing? You're crazy. And they got that flinch from during the drinking years when I used to go after them because I couldn't get to Lindsay. Anyway, I didn't like the guys in AA, mainly because Lindsay was never home. She spent all her time drinking in bars. She's sober up, and she ain't home. You know, she goes out traipsing out the door, and then she comes back in and she talks about Dwight and Bobby Lee and all these people. thinking she went to the bars and met all the guys. Now she's going to AA and meeting all the guys. I mean, what the heck? You think my life got any better? At least in the bars, she didn't come home talking about the guys' names. I mean, all of a sudden, she's getting bold talking about them when she comes in here. And I didn't understand, and I didn't like any of them. It's funny, too, and I got to relate this to you because this is two incidents in the early months. I remember Lindsay coming home one night, and we were having a serious discussion. Actually, it was a pot party with two friends of mine. Any of you that have ever smoked, you never sit on a chair. You always lay on the floor, and you always turn the lights down low, and we're just laying there, just mellow out. Lindsay comes in, sits on the sofa, and says she's had a spiritual awakening. You ever want to ruin a pot party sometime, just go for it. It'll happen, I guarantee you. They can't handle that. It was like throwing water on that group. I mean, they just looked. But a lot of strange things going on like that then. I did not like Lindsay sober. We were in a bowling league at that time, and this is the point I had come to in my life. This is where the anger... I knew this much about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew she couldn't drink at all. And I thought, now's the time for me to get even. You see, a few years before this, I had quit drinking as a good example. We'd go to parties and I wouldn't drink, and I'd be stoned out of my gourd. But I didn't drink, and I was saying, see, you can go to the party and you don't have to drink. Now that I was miserable and having a lousy time, I didn't consider that part of the example. But that's the way it was. Well, we went to this bowling league that night. I had two other friends with us who were on our team. And they just put a bar in the league, in the alley. I'm a cheap son of a gun, too. I don't spend much money. Lindsay's a spender in the group. Not that it's my fault for not spending it. But anyway, I decided to treat these other two people to eat as much booze as they wanted that night. Lindsay was 30 days sober. You know how you sit at the table and write the score down? I'd sit there and take the drink and put it right in front of her on the score pad. For 3.5 hours I did that. I got so drunk they almost had to carry me out of the place. And it was, you see there, you see what you put me through, this is what it's going to be like. Didn't feel good on the inside, though. This getting even doesn't feel good on the inside. But that's where I was. That's where my head was. Shortly after that, Lindsay was leaving one night, or I wish I could remember the way it was. It was about a month and a half after she came in. She said something to the effect that there's a group they'd like to see you. And I thought, well, now my mind, good, solid thinking now, you can stay home, babysit the kids, or you can go out the door. Well, I decided to go out the door. And I said, second of all, I get to meet Dwight and Bobby Lee and all these folks, see what they look like, find out what the competition's like. So I went. Turned out, Dwight, if you ever come down in our area, let me know and I'll introduce you to Dwight because Dwight's about this tall. And when he doesn't have his toupee on, he's about this tall. And I love him to death, but it turned out Dwight was more afraid of me than I was of him. And I came in looking macho anyway with a beard. And if you can imagine me looking macho. I wanted to all my life, but at 5'9", it was kind of tough. I came in, and there they were, and you know what they were doing. They were drinking coffee, and they were laughing, and they were having a good time, and I said, my God, I can't stay here. I can't be around this. They're going to find out what I'm like and who I am, and they're going to throw me out of this place. But they all came over, and they put their arms around me, and they shook hands, and they hugged, and they gave me coffee, and we laughed and joked until 8 o'clock. The meeting started. They said, you go that way. And I went in this room with about five women, and little bitty chairs.
And humility in those folding chairs, right on one of those. Right. And it was funny. It's typical, and I go to meetings today, and like Lindsay told you, we go to a lot of meetings. When I'm on the road, I go to a lot of meetings. They're all the same. Newcomer comes in, and you go around the table and talk about how crazy you are, and that's exactly what they did. They went around the table and talked about how crazy. When they got back around to me, I thought, these people are crazy. They're really crazy. And maybe I need to stick around to bring some kind of sanity to this group. And I said, okay. And, you know, nobody checks our motives when we come in the door. You know, nobody cares why you come in as long as you come in. And you can keep coming back as long as you want to keep coming back. And I lied, and I was not honest, and it was total ego coming in the room. Again, it was a choice staying home with the kids or going there, and I did. And I went. All my anger and all my frustrations, I talked to the people later and they said, you're probably one of the angriest people we've ever seen come in. And I thought I was such a neat guy walking in that door. I really did think I was a neat person. And I was furious. God, the rage that was inside me. It used to come out in the arguments and the fights, the rage, the slamming and breaking doors. And that was my thing. I kept coming back, and there was some neat people there, one in particular. Some of you might have heard her a couple of years ago down in Charleston, Carol H. She used to be state delegate. She spoke at AA conference down there. She was my sponsor. Lindsay got a man, I got a woman. I didn't have much choice. Just, I told you I get a little controversial, and maybe I am here now, and I understand that men are supposed to have men and women are supposed to have women, but in my group there weren't any other men. And I'll tell you this, and this is my opinion, if you've only got one guy around in your group and you won't offer him any kind of sponsorship, you might be killing him. I came in this group lonely and frustrated, completely lonely. I hated myself, and these people put their arms around me, and they loved me. And my life came through this program, both of them. Carol kind of took me under her wing, and she did a lot of tail kicking. She's hard-nosed, if you ever met her or ever heard her. God, I hated that woman sometimes. Not as much as my mom, but pretty close. Oh, I love you, Dottie. Carol liked the steps. Every problem you had went to the steps, and that's where the answer was. She and her big old husband, Dave, took Lindsay and I and really helped us through. And Dwight and all the AAs combined together to bring us through. And it's unbelievable where we've come to today. Like Lindsay said, it wasn't any tiptoeing through the tulips. We went through some very, very... It's always tough. We were playing bridge at one of these things with a fellow I know and respect, an AA member. And we were talking about the toughest year, the program, and he's leaning over there. He's a pretty wise person. Not a wise guy, but a very wise man. He said the toughest year is the one you're in. And pretty true. I was pushed very hard into some places I didn't want to go. I was sent to a place called Bonnie Doon, which is in South Carolina, and it's a weekend Al-Anon get-together. And I showed up, 115 women and about five guys. There are some benefits to this program. I walked in that door, and Carol's a neat person, tough. I told you she was tough. I walked in the door, and Bonnie Doon was a place where people hugged and loved. There's a lot of love there. And she walked in the door, and everybody threw their arms around Carol because they knew her, and she left. And I'm standing there with a suitcase, and people started hugging me. And Lindsay talking about this bit, that's where it was. I didn't want anybody touching me. And those people were so happy, and I was so damn miserable. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to turn around and go back, but I couldn't because I bought three other people, and they didn't have a way back. So I stayed there the whole weekend. And they've got a thing called sharing time where you get up and just speak. It's called Speak Your Mind, and you've got 3 or 5 minutes to stand up and just speak your mind at this place. I've been in about 6 months. And they make you guilty because everybody's supposed to get up and say something. And after a while, more people have been up than are sitting down outside. You know your turn's going to come, and Carol's over there saying, "Get up, get up, get up." And I didn't want to get up. I was scared. I didn't know what I was going to say, and my insides were kind of flaky right then. They were really, I don't know. I thought I wanted what they had, but I wasn't quite sure. I don't know whether you've ever been there. What they had was going to involve a lot of pain to go through to get it, and where I was, even though it was bad, I might want to stay here anyway. And I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but that's where I was. I said, "Okay, God, I'll make you a deal." I said, "I'm going to stand up, and the rest of it's up to you." Because once you stand up, people say, "Oh, he's going to walk up. You can't sit back down." So I stood up, and I walked up front, and I started to open my mouth. And this, again, beard, macho time, you know, I wanted to be. I cried like a baby for 5 minutes. Just cried like, couldn't open my mouth. I'm not talking about just tears. I'm talking about the... I cried so much it hurt. I mean, but it felt so good. I was smiling. And those people stood up. 115 people clapped for 3 minutes. When you can't make it in this program, as people to carry you, all you have to do is to keep coming back. That's the only requirement that there is in this program. And to be an Al-Anon, all we have to do is to come to meetings and practice the program. And it's really, as Lindsay was saying earlier, it's simple. It's real simple. That was the beginning. We did go through a period. I'll be honest with you, my motive for practicing the steps in this program was one motive entirely. I listened pretty shrewdly. I consider myself an intelligent person. That's one of my problems with the program. You cannot intellectualize this program. There's no way. If you don't want to get it, try and think your way through it. You won't. I guarantee you. This is an emotional program, and it's full of love and God and understanding. Don't try and think your way through it. I'll save you some time. I had a very close friend of mine from Bonnie Doon. He's no longer with us, but he looked at me one time after I knew him about 3 years, and I felt kind of huffy and puffy. I've been back to Bonnie Doon about 3 years. I was one of the old-timers. He looked at me in the eye, and he said, "I've got you figured out." I never liked anybody that had me figured out because I didn't have me figured out, and it scared me. He looked at me and he said, "I got you all figured out." He said, "If you ever wanted to plant a garden, you'd get every book you could and read up on gardening, and you'd never put a spade to the ground the first time." I didn't like that man the first time I met him, and I liked him less then. I love Ken to death because he hit it right on the head. I was trying to think my way through this program, and I wasn't letting the body and the emotions carry me through and get to work on the inside. You can't read your way into this program. You got to share and you got to let it out. And it's got to come out. You got to clean house. All right. The only reason I practice steps in this program is to get a divorce. I had heard in the meetings, and you told me that like 95% of the people that get a divorce in marriages find another alcoholic. And I figured, here's where my mind went. I said, well, if I get sane first, and you told me to work the steps, I get sane. First I'll get sane, then I'll dump her, and then I'll find me, I won't find an alcoholic. Hey, I worked the steps because of that. Nobody checked my motive. The few people that know about it said, okay, go ahead. Just love the one you're with and go ahead and do what you want. So I did. And I went separate meetings. We'd say, "You going to meet tonight?" I'd say, "Yeah, are you? Where are you going?" "I'm going over here." "I'm going over here." We drank a lot of gas, and we didn't have the money, but we stayed separated. And it was a funny thing. Halfway through the steps, I found out I was in love with that woman. It's been tough. A few things, I'm fixing to end this thing too. I want to share a few things about relationships and my relationship with Lindsay. We couldn't stay together and we couldn't live apart as before. After 2 years in this program, we seriously talked about divorce. I didn't want to be here. I didn't love her. I was angry with her. She said stupid things. She just wanted a list. Anytime she opened her mouth, I was waiting for her. You know, that's dumb. That's stupid. And I had her nailed. After working the steps and being around, incidentally, we had to be around healthy couples. We had to be around people with good marriages that loved each other. That happened, and I'm not sure why. Evidently, God had a big hand in who we were around, and these are the people we wanted to be with, the people with good marriages. Ended up falling back in love with this woman. I had to put my arms around her and hug her when she didn't want to be hugged, and she had to do that to me. I remember one time standing in my kitchen, putting my arms around this woman, and looking out the window and just watching. Absolutely no feeling. There was nothing there. And I thought, gee, this will be over soon and I can go about what I'm supposed to be doing. This is when you got your arms around your wife of, gosh, I don't know, it was 13, 14 years at that time. But if you fake it till you make it, all of a sudden those hugs had some meaning to them. And they became important to us. Ken, the guy who told me about planting the garden, put me to work. Ken told me when you look in the mirror, if there's nothing else you can hang on to, remember there's a man that named Ken, and he loves you. And when I get up and look in the mirror, and I didn't like the person in the mirror, I thought about Ken. And I thought, well, Ken loves me. Nobody else does. And for you, if you're having problems there and if you look in the mirror and you don't like who you are, there's a guy named Richard and he loves you. Guarantee you. It was scary. Ken told me that I had to look at that face in the mirror and tell him I loved him. And folks, that was hard and I couldn't do it silent. I had to do it out loud. And I had to look in the mirror at Richard and I had to say, Richard, I love you. And maybe it sounds hokey to you. I don't know. It sounded hokey to me when I did it. I got caught at it once. It was kind of embarrassing. But you know something? The guy that told me to do it had such a good program, and I loved him so much. If that didn't stop me from doing it, I kept on doing it. And I got comfortable with it. And there's days I can do it, and there's days I can't. But I love Richard today. He's a child of God. And I know God loves me. And I know Richard loves me. And if you think that's ego, well, try it sometime for a period of time and see how it feels. I never could say I love myself before. I've got a self-respect today that I never had before. We've been through some good times and some bad times. You heard from David today, and we found out we could hug our children, and our children can hug us. I still hug and kiss my children today, and I feel more for it today. Recently, I've been with the company for 11 years. I'm still selling. I found out that I was not happy where I was, and I was bringing my job home, and I was scared because I was making what I felt was a very good income for what I was doing. And I've been with this company, like I say, for 11 years, and I was the top person there. Top salesperson, and everybody looked up to me, and I was getting all the accolades, but I wasn't comfortable there. I wasn't happy. I wasn't growing. So I had to make a change, and recently she mentioned John. I've taken on an addition of an AA sponsor. John's got 25 years in the program. I'll meet John for lunch. I'll call up and say, John, I need to talk to you. And John will drop what he's doing. He owns his own corporation. And we're at lunch and we're talking. 6 months ago, John talked me into staying where I was. I wanted to leave. I wanted to leave fast. And he put down on paper why I should stay where I was. And I stayed at it 3 months. And I gave it the best shot I could. And I realized it wasn't working. And I had to make a change. I got together again with John. Told him it wasn't working. Anyway, to make a long story short, I just went with a new company. And I've been really scared. And it's been, in fact, getting up here tonight, my head was not together. And if the talk wasn't together, I apologize. Half of my head goes with the company every now and then. I took a 30% cut in salary, a straight commission job. When Eric graduates from school this coming year, he'll be a senior. When he graduates in May, we're going to move to Mobile, Alabama. We're 3 or 4 generations in Atlanta. We're going to pack up, throw everything in the car, and move to Mobile, Alabama, and start in a new territory. The company has never had anybody there before. It is green as grass, and I'm going to be in straight commission in this territory. And half of me is terrified. Totally terrified. So we're going to go down in Labor Day, take a look around, get some meetings real fast, find out what kind of program we got down there. We asked John what kind of, how the AA was down in Mobile. He said they're bored, they need some help. So we're going to go down there. But the inside of me is terrified. And the only reason that I can reach out and make some of these changes that require some growth on my part. Incidentally, the company I am going with has been founded on a spiritual foundation. The letter from the president that I got when I went to work with the company talked about the spiritual nature of this company and how everything they do is towards a spiritual end. And it's a sales company that sells products. Unbelievable that I got a hold of these people. And they love and went, had a sales meeting with 6 guys, went down to Jekyll Island, cocktail parties and all the rest, and only 1 out of the 6 drinks. And it's wild. And I've had a hard time with companies before because everybody drinks where I go and I get uncomfortable with them sometimes. Anyway, I'm beginning to ramble and I'm going to shut up. Well, we've had some laughs and a couple of tears up here, and I thank you very much for allowing my family to come here and share. And God love each and every one of you. I love you. Thank you.